This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today by an author and researcher. Previous books include Chasing Ghosts and The Big Book of Mars, here to discuss his new book, just released on the 17th of October worldwide, titled We Are Not Alone, Mr. Mark Hartsman. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Andy, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Very good to finally get you on too. And hello to all the folks on YouTube seeing the new full HD camera. Hi, people have been requesting it for a while, so this is the face. Sorry about that. Listen, Mark, but this is all about you. I want to kick off lots of things to discuss with the new book, We Are Not Alone. But what's your background first and foremost? Because looking through the website, weirdhistorian.com, your previous titles that you've worked on, what's kind of led you to this point in your life you're writing about UFOs?
I think it's all been leading right up to it, to be honest. So yeah, I run a website called weirdhistorian.com, and I love just all the sort of weird pages of history, the stranger sides of things. And I've loved that since I was a kid, really. You mentioned Chasing Ghosts, the Big Book of Mars, but even books I did before that, I've written about sideshow performers. I've written about Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head and its travels for 300 years, weird things on eBay. So I just love these sort of stranger, like I said, you know, the weirder pages of history, really. In terms of UFOs, I mean, it's something that I also enjoyed reading about as a kid and was fascinated by. And then when I wrote The Big Book of Mars, I had touched on the UFO subject a little bit, because obviously there was some belief that, you know, early UFO sightings might be from Martians coming to Earth to, you know, investigate, or concerns about our atomic age. So these were some of those early beliefs in the late 40s and early 1950s. So I had written about Roswell a little bit and some other instances around that same period. But of course, there was so much more to talk about in the subject. So after doing Chasing Ghosts, I decided I want to dive more into the UFO subject. And so that's what We Are Not Alone, like I said, just came out. Here's what that looks like. Beautiful hardcover book, lots of images inside. But yeah, it was great to just really kind of dive in and explore the subject in a much broader way than I could with the Mars book.
Normally, I like to have a copy of the guest book, but given it was just coming out, I got the PDF from you, so folks will be used to me saying, here's a copy as well, and it'll be on that pile eventually. I'm going to pick up a copy of the physical book as well. And this isn't even something I've wrote down to ask you, but in looking through the PDF, are you a fan of Wes Anderson, the director, Wes Anderson movies?
I've seen a bunch of his movies, and yeah, they're beautiful. I mean, the art direction is always so.
That's what so the layout of the book reminded me of, that kind of quirky, the colors, yeah. Even, and I've just seen Asteroid City quite recently, and it just reminded me of that sort of layout, and obviously UFO subject and all, but I just wondered if that was deliberate, but just something I noticed and thought, I wonder if that's in there for that reason.
Yeah, no, Quirk, it's funny you said quirky, the publisher is Quirk Books, and they have just a beautiful design aesthetic. I mean, I'll try and flip through here a little bit just so people can see, but it's great. I mean, they give me such a chance to put so much imagery in. I mean, things like this, if I could just touch on really quick. These came from, if you know David Marler, he runs a UFO archive.
I do, yeah. It's
amazing. So I spent a few days with him down outside of Albuquerque. And I mean, this is coming straight from his files. This is about the Socorro case, you know, an image of a diorama that was made, which I'd never seen anywhere before. And then the actual Project Blue Book cards, I got a few of those that are included in the book, like the actual physical card, not just a scan that's online or something. So having the like physical pieces that relate to cases is one thing I was really excited to be able to include in the book from a range of cases.
It's nice seeing that as you go through. It's not just a picture book by any means, but it's so well broken up and very well presented that I'm not just blowing smoke up your arse, because I wouldn't just say that. It's very nicely put together. And I know Dan, who puts together the thumbnail for me, incorporated some of that art into the thumbnail, and he was a fan of the way it was presented as well. So whoever done that, they've done a very good job on that for you. When did you start writing this particular book? Because coincidentally, Mark, you must know it's a hell of a time for a UFO book to come out. you're hot on the heels of congressional hearings, UFO documentaries on Netflix, and a whole host of stories. Has it just been a pleasant timing for you?
Yeah, it has been. It definitely worked out nicely. I mean, I started this book, I'd say, just over 2 years ago. So probably around summer of 2021, really got going with writing on it. So I guess that was like just after that first report to Congress from the Pentagon. I think that was June 2021, if I remember correctly, the date. So you know, certainly it's been a topic that's been, you know, getting more and more attention nationally and with a more serious angle to it, you know, which has been great. You know, the stigma is going away, which I think has been hugely helpful to learning and understanding more about the whole phenomena. So the timing was good, I think, at the beginning, but it's only gotten better and better with all the stories going on and the continued congressional hearings that have been happening. So it's definitely been, you know, really, really quite a relief to have all the news out there about this subject right now.
Yeah. So the book takes us through, I couldn't work out, is it, it's almost an ode to an encyclopedia and a bit of a step-by-step guide to the UFO subject and the history of the subject all kind of woven into one. It's really, honestly, I was pleasantly surprised when I went through it, especially when it's not someone who is a hardcore UFO guy, if I can say that, presenting, here's all the UFO stuff I know. And I really liked that about it, had a bit of a charm to it. And it starts off taking you through the journey from Roswell up to modern day, present day with the government side of things. But going back to that, the kind of start of the book then, did any of your research take you to much before Roswell? It's the birth of the modern UFO phenomenon, 1947. But when you were doing your digging, was there ever an idea for an earlier chapter where you were going to go back even further? Or did you think it has to be the, you know, the kind of mid-40s?
No, there was actually. I do in the finished book, I do go a little bit earlier, back to like the Battle of Los Angeles in 42. And then some of the Foo Fighters around World War II. So I get into some of that as well, just to kind of show, hey, it didn't exactly start with Kenneth Arnold in 47. There was stuff happening before that. So I did touch on that. And then I actually did have a whole first chapter that we ended up cutting when we were doing edits that was more about ancient history. And some of that is kind of spread out. We salvaged some of that and spread some of that throughout the book. So we still touch on some of those early thoughts that could be, you know, a UFO phenomena. Not to say that people thought it was UFO then, but it's looking back. Could that have been what people were experiencing, written about or described in their own language of the time? So some of that goes back to the Bible. Of course, there's lots of books on UFOs in the Bible, right? I actually see UFO and God right behind you there. So
Chris Bledsoe's book.
So there's I definitely touched on some of that. Some of the thoughts about, like, you know, the pyramids and things like this, was those ancient alien types of theories. So I get into some of that, but not as thoroughly as I had at one point in the book.
And I wonder, going through it, it references obviously the times, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Did popular culture for you as you're researching this and from what you've experienced massively reflect on how people viewed the UFO subject at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of did. I mean, so much of that in pop culture was I think, you know, kind of related. I mean, maybe more sophisticated in ways, though. It just depends on what movies you're thinking of, I suppose. I mean, certainly there's plenty of B movies where I could say, yeah, it did reflect it with, like, meeting Venusians and Martians and things like that, and traveling spaceships to planets.
That's what I'm thinking. Some of the lines we are talking about, I've got the gentleman's name, Gabriel Green. And in the 60s, and I'm going to ask you to talk about that in a second, but talking about Venusians and Martians coming here, collaborating, connecting with the human race, that notion now seems very old school, doesn't it? That people are coming, or aliens are coming from local planets, and it's just moved on to a whole different conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And I was going to say, the reason I was saying, like, some, it depends on which pop culture you're thinking of, because, like, 2001 to me, you know, late, that to me holds up really beautifully, actually.
Yeah, true.
But the more fun B movie type stuff, it was such a different atmosphere at that time. I mean, that I have a pretty nice section on the contactees of the 1950s and early 60s. The people, like you mentioned, Gabriel Green, which we can talk about more. But, you know, George Adamski and Daniel Fry, some of these other guys who claim to have met Venusians and flown in spaceships and wrote these books on them. I'm blocking them with my chair, but I got a whole shelf full of these books that I love. I love the titles, and I think I mentioned this in the book. I loved how they actually try to one up each other. It felt like, I'll see if I can find it really quick, the page in the book, but you know, I met a Martian and I met a Venusian, and then I flew to Venus. I met a Venusian wife, and then I had a Venusian family. And someone wrote a book like, I've been to the moon, to Mars and Venus, you know? So it was like, how can we keep one upping it? Here's a page, for example, some of these great book covers. This is the one I just mentioned, my trip to Mars, the moon and Venus. It might be a little dark to read from the video, but I love that whole era. It's definitely, like you said, the thoughts has changed drastically because we know there aren't people on Mars and Venus. We might still find like some microorganisms on the surface or in the atmosphere of Venus, that so life might exist still, but certainly not like what they were describing. It looks exactly like us, but usually better looking versions of us. So those stories are certainly kind of odd and unusual, but the message that they were giving, I always thought was really interesting, about the warnings of the atomic age and the dangers we have to ourselves. These people were almost like these kind of cult leaders. They would have lectures and they would have, it's like conventions where people come out and hear them speak, and they would preach this message, which, you know, knowing that they weren't really seeing Venusians, but the idea of preaching the dangers of the atomic age is certainly a positive message and a good thing. But what I find interesting about all that also is that you also have the fact that they're doing that and they're so vocal about it. And it becomes, to me, that's where a lot of the stigma comes in about UFOs. Like, you don't want to be associated with the guys who said they met the Venusians.
Yeah.
And so that starts to push like serious scientists away. Like, I can't be associated with this flying saucer crowd, the UFO crowd. And you have this massive gap of scientists sort of seriously taking an interest. I mean, of course you do have, you know, J. Allen Hynek with Blue Book looking into things and James McDonald, but for the most part, you know, scientists are kind of pushed away from this. And that's drastically changed now, which I think is amazing. I'm jumping ahead a lot and maybe steering away from your question. I apologize.
No, that's fine. And I was going to ask, because that was my next question on modern culture reflecting that. For quite a while now, and particularly right now, we're in a really heightened state of, you know, international tension. And do you think the way the UFO subject, and this, I only thought of this today, the way it's moved more into a military connection is because of that heightened international state of tension? You know, that's why we're hearing so much more about the Department of Defense, the gimbal, the FLIR video, the Tic Tac pictures, they're all in the book. Is that why we've got that now? And it's just a reflection of, you know, back then it was the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we're just in a modern version of that now.
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think what's a little different now is back then the government was looking into things, but they would always have an explanation for something. Or they would not acknowledge that it was a case. Like if you look at some of the sightings over nuclear sites in the '60s, the government didn't say, yes, there was a UFO there and we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
They just pushed it aside or didn't want people to talk about it. I find it quite different now that the government is actually acknowledging that there are UAPs. You know, I like that they changed the language to get away from the stigma that we were just talking about. But they're acknowledging the fact that they don't know what is flying overhead. Like the pilots are seeing something and we don't know what they are. And to me, that's a pretty amazing admission for them to make. To me, that's a little bit different. I don't know that the state of the world is causing them to see it. I mean, I feel like if the idea was that they were actually here because of the state of the world, that hopefully that they would do something, especially right about now, would be nice to see some intervention. But I think what's amazing is that we're taking it seriously now, as opposed to back then. And now you have real scientists looking into it. I think I talked to Avi Loeb and I wrote about that in the book, and I love what he's doing with the Galileo Project, because he's a unique figure that has amazing scientific credibility and resources. And now he's getting funding, and that is allowing, you know, when I spoke to him, had about 100 scientists working with him. but he's attracting scientists who feel okay about looking into the subject now and researching it openly. And so he's collecting his own data, and then he can start to learn from that data. He doesn't have to wait for the government to give him whatever they might give him, you know, or any of that kind of issue that's been experienced in the past. So I think it's an amazing time when scientists are taking a serious look at it. You know, NASA's obviously looking at it too. They haven't, their last meeting they had, there was nothing new to report other than maybe some thoughts on what some of the other UAPs were. But, you know, it's an interesting time to maybe learn something new finally, now that can be looked at more seriously.
Well, let me drag you back kicking and screaming to the 60s and talk about Gabriel Green for a few minutes, because that was a case and someone I didn't really know much about. Can you tell the listeners just a little bit about who he was and how he tried to extraordinarily run for president on the back of the UFO ticket?
Yeah, I got to show the picture. I just found the page as you were talking. So this is an actual ad from a newspaper that he placed. Gabriel Green, America needs a space age president. And the text here is pretty small, but for the most part, it is pretty readable. But he describes the fact that basically this was one of these guys, a contactee, who said spacemen came down to him and said that they wanted him to run for president. And so he did. He got on the ticket. He was on for like a few months. And this was 1960, so he was going up against John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, which was, you know, he didn't have much of a chance.
No, that's some heavy hitters politically. Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, he has a lot of good things in here. He says he wants a workable plan for peace rather than directionless confusion, hope and national purpose instead of apathy and hopelessness. So he promised a lot of, you know, good things that I guess he thought the spacemen, as he referred to them, would help him achieve, because clearly at that time the idea was all these people from space had achieved a certain level of enlightenment that we had yet to achieve here on Earth. So maybe they could help us find a better way forward as well. So he had this campaign, ran for a short while, and eventually, you know, it didn't go anywhere. He dropped out. He endorsed Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy, at least he got us to the moon. So there's a little bit of a space progress there that from his endorsement. But yeah, it's a pretty fun story that he literally ran for president. I also have, in 1972, he ran again, and he ran under the, I think it was the Universal ticket. And he had Daniel W. Fry as his running mate, who I mentioned earlier, who was a guy who, one of the first people to claim to have ridden in the flying saucer.
Yeah. And you know what? It was viewed at the time as something that really encouraged the stigma. People who would come out and say they had ridden on flying saucers, they had spoken to, as you say, spacemen from Venus, Mars, local planetary bodies, okay? And we don't get too dissimilar now, but it seems to be, at this point in time, taken much more seriously. I've got Grant Cameron's book, UFO Sky Pilots. We hear about folks who say they've piloted craft. It's got a lot more complex, a lot more complicated. People talk about consciousness being how these crafts are piloted, and speaking to other spirits from far, far, far away planets and planetary bodies. But the idea is still there. But as you say, it's nice to see that conversation can be had, but with that stigma being removed. I can't see anyone, though, like a Gabriel Green running for president now, because while the stigma is reduced, Mark, I feel that that's maybe a push too far. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think he'd have much success. But it is interesting, just going back to that time when we just had so much less knowledge about the plants closest to us, right? And so you could project ideals onto those plants because they were close and we didn't really know for sure. And now that we have more information, we project further and further, you know, further out into space, which is such a fascinating discussion, really, of the what could be, because there is so much possibility. And I have there's a whole chapter in the book that gets into more scientific efforts, which covers kind of a brief history of early astronomical beliefs, some of the early beliefs in Martians and things like that. Because to me, it's all like a chain of events that one leads to another and inspires future generations of thought and so forth. But I get up to SETI and Frank Drake, who had the Drake equation, which estimated the number of intelligent civilizations in the galaxy. which he had a high number in his estimate, although he didn't believe that they could get here due to the distances between solar systems and worlds and so forth, which is massive. I mean, I think about those numbers, you know, a light year is 6 trillion plus miles. We talk about exoplanets, you know, thousands of light years away. It's hard to fathom covering that distance. At the same time, who knows, you know, if they're 1,000 years ahead of us, can't even imagine what might be possible. So it keeps the conversation interesting. So there's a lot of, I think, fascinating thought around there. I also talk about another planetary scientist who explores the idea of this Drake equation and the number of intelligent civilizations that might exist within the galaxy. And he has a less optimistic number based on certain things, like things that I think most of us don't really think about. You know, you think of like the number of stars, and there's, you know, hundreds of billions of stars. That's a lot. The numbers are huge. So you got to figure the odds that something is living out there seems like, you know, should be in our favor for life. But he talks about things like gamma ray bursts, which happen more in the center of the galaxy or on the edge of the galaxy, which is safer. And a gamma ray burst, like these huge explosions, like imagine all the power of our sun exploding within the timeline of like 24 hours, like all that power wipes out anything in its way. So if planets had life, they'd just be gone, you know, it would wipe out before maybe it could get to where we are beyond. Or so these kinds of things happen across the galaxy, which starts to eliminate some of those opportunities and possibilities. So again, just gets into like different things to think about that maybe people don't always consider when they're thinking about the vastness of space, the possibility. But again, I think it just kind of adds more to the conversation and the imagination.
I agree. I had Nadia Drake, who is Frank Drake's daughter, on the podcast a couple of months ago. She's been part of the NASA panel who has put together the independent study on UAP. Oh, great. And it was a controversial guest. She was lovely to speak to, and I enjoyed that. But as a scientist who doesn't come at the UFO subject from I'm a believer and there's aliens out there, she tried to really approach it very pragmatically. And for her, there still seemed to be a massive lack of real tangible scientific evidence. And that frustrated a lot of people. But I think, like you say, you have to look at both sides of the argument. You can't just go into this full pelt, you know, 100% there is something because I believe it. You have to allow other scientists to come in and say, but it might not be the case because of X, Y, and Z. But that's where if real scientists can get involved on both sides of the argument, they can discuss, they can debate, they can present their reasons, and maybe you can move on from that point rather than that kind of constant infighting. And I welcome any scientist or academic who wants to come into the subject and have that conversation. Did you find it easy in your research to speak to scientists, journalists, academics on the topic who maybe weren't UFO-centric, shall we say?
So it was interesting. I think in some cases it was easy. I was able to do it without an issue. In other cases, I had to maybe overcome a hurdle or two, which was interesting. So I'll describe that. But I had the one scientist I mentioned, his name is Pascal Lee, who had the thought about, like, you know, maybe a more limited answer. He believes that we might be it in terms of an intelligent species in this galaxy.
That's on a big one-page quote. I remember reading that within the book, and it's that scary thought of, to paraphrase, you know, that we might be it, and that's a horrible, daunting thought just in itself. But sorry if I interrupted, but yeah, that was a lovely piece.
Yeah, I mean, he's very thoughtful about the whole subject. So I had reached out to him initially because I met him through the Big Book of Mars. He was hugely helpful with that book. And so he gave me his thoughts. He actually had a great thought on Roswell that's in the book, which we can talk about as well. But just kind of got into his beliefs about, like, the idea of extraterrestrial intelligent life. And he connected me to a few other scientists at SETI because he's associated with SETI. So I was able to speak with Seth Shostak at SETI, which he was amazing. And Jill Tarter, who's terrific. She's, you know, one of the helped get SETI off the ground at the very beginning. She's, if anyone here has seen the movie Contact, Jodie Foster's character was based on Jill Tarter. So she was great to talk to. And she talked about too, like, the things happening now. She's like, I need more data. She's like, everything is so transient that we don't have enough data to really learn anything yet. So I can't make any kind of, you know, conclusion based on what's out there currently. So they take, you know, it's taking a very scientific approach to it, which is what they're supposed to do, right? That's what science is collecting data and seeing what the data points to, not trying to direct data to what you want it to be. I reached out to a few others who were great and got right back to me. I mean, I was thrilled Avi Loeb got back to me through an introduction, which was great to speak with him. But when I went to NASA Goddard, I had to go through their head of communications, and so she checked out my background before she would let me talk to the scientists there, which was it was like, oh, okay, I didn't know I'd have to go through a system to make sure I could speak to someone. But fortunately, she said, oh, you know, I like what you do, like your writing, you know, and I can connect you. But we have to make sure whenever the topic is UFOs that we record the conversations and we make sure that, you know, nothing is getting out there from our scientists that might reflect bad on them later and might misquote them or explain something wrong that they're trying to say. So I worked closely with one of their scientists. I actually had him review what I wrote for his ideas to make sure it was clear and it was accurate. So I felt good about that. But this particular scientist was talking about the idea of technosignatures, which I find really fascinating. And I'll just try and describe that quickly. But so there's biosignatures and there's technosignatures. Biosignatures are evidence that we might get from an atmosphere of an exoplanet that might say to us that there's some sort of biological creature on that planet that's, you know, emitting some sort of gas or whatever it might be in the atmosphere. So you can say it's a biosignature, evidence of some form of life. A technosignature is evidence of some form of technology on the planet. So technology that might be polluting something. So you can gather data on pollution in the atmosphere, which is something that the James Webb Telescope is starting to, should be able to do. I don't know if it's come back with that yet offhand, but it's capable. And then there's another telescope that will follow James Webb that can also detect other elements within the atmosphere without getting overly technical. But basically they can start to discover whether or not these elements that they're detecting in the atmosphere could be created by technology versus other means. And so that's a pretty fascinating way to look for life. But as they point out also, we might find technology on an exoplanet, but that doesn't mean that there's life on the planet necessarily. And the evidence for that is Mars is a great example. There's technology there, but no one's living there because we put it there. So it's kind of a fun question. Like, we may find technology, but we might not find life. And then the next question is, okay, well, where's the life to put it there? So the mystery just kind of goes on. But I love the fact that we're this close to being able to find that kind of information on exoplanets. Like, that to me is awesome. So I feel like within our lifetime, we might get some real answers about something out there. Whether or not that's coming here, I don't know if we'll find that out or not. But even if we know that there is something else out there somewhere, I find that incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I love the idea that we might find someone else's space junk or rover just sitting on another planet and it's, who left that there? And like you say, the questions that would open up are just absolutely immense. Maybe someone's already sent their space junk here, and the likelihood is if something landed on this planet, it would land in the ocean and we would never find it just because of the surface of the planet, the body being covered in so much water. And I believe from the statistics, if something did hit land, it would almost definitely hit desert because so few areas of the planet are actually populated. So again, the likelihood is we wouldn't find it. So
yeah,
we're so used to the planet being so small now, but really it's still huge in that respect as well. So
that's a good point. And even like just the idea of like the space junk, I mean, that's really Avi Loeb's theory on Oumuamua.
Oumuamua, yeah.
From 2017, the thing that floated through the solar system. His theory is because the data we have on it doesn't reflect or align with anything that we're aware of, comets, meteorites, whatever it is, like, because it doesn't align with that, his thought is, well, maybe it's something else, as opposed to trying to force fit it into what we already know. And that's where he thought, well, maybe it's extraterrestrial, alien architecture, basically, just like a remnant left over that's passing through. So again, it's a fascinating way to think. And when you open your mind to that way of thinking, then you can start to investigate and learn.
You mentioned an alternative theory or thinking to Roswell previously. Do you want to go into that? Feel free.
Yeah, I thought this was a really interesting theory. So when I talked, again, his name is Pascal Lee. And when I talked to him, he offered to me, said, hey, I have this theory about Roswell. because I asked about his thoughts on the topic, you know, as a whole. And because he's a scientist, you know, anything he writes has to be peer reviewed. It's got to have data. Of course, that's, you know, that's that world. So he said, I can't really write this up because, you know, I don't have any data. It's just all conjecture. But he said, but, you know, I can share it with you, and that's something that you can print. So I was like, oh, this is terrific. Please tell me. So his thought is quite interesting. Basically, he's taking all the lore that's out there about Roswell, and he has an explanation that would account for all that within a more terrestrial explanation. So the government, of course, came out later and said Project Mogul was saying it was a high altitude spy balloon, right? Mm. So they were using some new materials. Mylar would have been a pretty new material. So the when they found like the foil and it felt different, it would be understandable that it wouldn't be recognizable to everybody who might encounter it. So of course, you know, we're trying to overlook, you know, look at what the Soviets are doing with their nuclear program and trying to make sure that they're, you know, they're not devising anything that's going to be a threat to us. So it's the Cold War. And so the idea of the high altitude spy balloon certainly aligns with what was going on in the world. He thought that what might also be happening is they may have been testing the effects of high altitude on what the biological response that might be. So they may have been mm-hmm. using monkeys to test.
Yeah.
Of course, we were sending monkeys into space. I found evidence of at least from early 48 of monkeys being sent up to space from New Mexico in the area. So who's to say it wasn't happening a little bit earlier, just without being recorded or reported somewhere that I could, at least I could find. Not only might they have been testing biological responses, but if they were doing that, they'd have like the nodes all over their body to test the reactions. So they would have shaved the monkey. Mm-hmm. So the monkey would have been gray skinned, a large head, you know, long limbs and rather short, like child sized.
Yeah.
He also thought they might be training them to take pictures over the Soviets. So at that time you didn't have like a remote camera. You know, that stuff wasn't, we didn't have that technology yet. So they would train monkeys, like push a button and you get like a banana, like a chip as a treat, right? So they may have been training them to do that as well. So we're going to fly the balloon up. We're going to test the biological responses on monkeys. They're going to take pictures over Moscow for us. And then of course, something crashes. It went awry and bodies are found. And from a distance, one might say, I saw a weird, gray, small, childlike body with long limbs and a big head. And you can see how everything just kind of fits together with that explanation from there. So I thought that was an interesting way to look at that. I had not come across anywhere else.
I've heard a few similar. I've heard the more horrific one where it was actual radiated bodies of children or captivated prisoners of war, things like that. I still feel there's a huge element, and this is the issue with Roswell. I've said before, it happened so long ago, and like you say, there's a lack of data. What you have at this point is stories passed on through generations, because not only are the people who were present long passed away, their grandchildren are now passed away. So it's you know, stories handed down. Personally, I think it was still something a little bit more, especially with the material. One thing, yes, experimental materials, but if it's true that he crushed that up and it folded back out perfectly and had that kind of bluish glow to it,
yeah.
But is that a case of that something that was added to a story later? Who knows? But Roswell, it's one of those.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I don't think we'll ever find out necessarily what happened at Roswell, even if and when we get some sort of confirmation of a non-human intelligence. It just happened too long ago and was maybe too much of a cover-up. But it's a fascinating story, and no doubt there's still aspects, like you say, to it that we don't understand. I would love to ask you though, Mark, in writing the book, is there one particular case or piece of evidence you came across, whether it's in the book or not, that you really thought, wow, that for you is what you would tell folks not interested in the UFO subject, that this is the best thing I've seen, the best thing I've heard, the most compelling case?
I mean, there's a few. I think just to start, like, I think I certainly do think the recent UAP sightings by the Navy pilots is, to me, hugely compelling, because these are guys, I don't know why they would make any of this stuff up. These are guys highly skilled and very expensive equipment. So I find that really very compelling. But that's, I think that's something that's well known out there. So a few more lesser known, well, at least one lesser known one from the book for sure. There's one story I wrote about from the 70s. It took place in Lumberton, North Carolina. And it's an amazing story of a triangular UFO that was spotted. And what I particularly love about this story is that it was a friend of mine who witnessed it. It was a guy named Lee Spiegel, who's a huge name in the UFO community. Sadly, just passed away in August, which was so awful. But Lee's an old friend of mine, and he was hugely helpful in this book. And so in the 70s, he was working with J. Allen Hynek, who had Kufos at that time. And this sighting happened in North Carolina, and Hynek couldn't go. He sent Lee Spiegel down, and Lee goes down there, and he meets with the police chief, and they start following some of the sightings, the reports they're hearing. They're not seeing anything. But then finally they do, and they pull off the side of the road, and they see this triangular UFO that's like treetop level high, and lights and everything, perfectly silent. Shoots a beam down at their feet. There's a story that I think that happened. Another officer elsewhere had the beam react to his headlights, like flashed headlights twice. The beam came down twice, like mimicking it. And then it took off, just zipped off perfectly quietly. They tried to chase it, but they lost it. And, you know, Lee's a guy I know, like I said, personally. To me, it was a little bit different to know someone who's personally had an experience versus the stories you hear from people and you know, you don't quite know. But I know Lee, and I don't see him as a guy who's just making stuff up. So to me, that was extra intriguing because he also researched it. It's not like he just saw it and then he went back to Hynek. He researched the whole thing. He checked in with the local Air Force bases to see, like, were you testing something? Was there a pilot in this area? Was there a different kind of aircraft that we may have seen? And nothing they got from the Air Force bases lined up with anything that they saw, timing-wise or equipment-wise or anything like that. So it's one of those cases that was never explained. And it was multiple witnesses. You know, again, police chief. I think there were a few other police officers with Lee and the chief as well. So it wasn't just like one guy who saw something and then reported it later. It's multiple people who saw something, no explanation at all. And so to me, that was a really interesting case to be able to share. And it gets more details in the book. And then along those lines, another fairly well-known one is the Phoenix Lights in 1997, which sounds very similar to what Lee experienced, but was seen by 20,000 people, including the governor, who, although he at first kind of mocked the whole thing, which I talked about that in the book, but he later came out and said, no, I did see it. I don't know what it was. And I believe he'll say that to this day. Yeah. And I actually found out after the fact that a friend of mine sent me a note saying that she was actually there at the time and she saw it as well. And so you have these triangular craft again going over Phoenix and in a much broader area as well, by the way, but seen by tons of people, said to be physical, quiet, triangular lights just going by. I actually talked about Kurt Russell saw it in a private plane that he was flying.
He did, yeah.
His experience with that as well. And again, you have like the local Air Force base. They talked about dropping flares around that time, but that doesn't align either with what people experienced. I think people would know the difference between flares dropping and a very even sighting of a triangular craft. So that's another one that really doesn't have an explanation to this day, which I find pretty fascinating. I don't know why someone would test something and never say anything about it, especially this long after the fact. So I don't know. Those are a few, I think, examples that I was especially intrigued by.
I've said many times I'm a huge fan of the Phoenix Lights event because the frustration is it was so close to us having camera phones and that kind of digital product on us, but it was just a couple of years still outside of that purview. However, I think if you go back historically, you would have a really good level of satellite technology, radar tech, various sensors that should and could and probably did pick something up in that area. So if you were a UAP task force or an ARRO organization now who's looking back historically, 1947 is a pretty long way to go back, but 1997 isn't that far, and the records would be digitized, the tape would be there, audio, written records, people are still alive from that. So I always hold out hope that's one that someday we can get a little bit more from. But I'm a huge advocate for that being a pretty monumental sighting.
Yeah, that would be amazing to see if there is some data about from satellites, or like you said, that could give us a little bit more light on that subject. That would be fascinating to find out.
I would put money on the fact that there is, and yeah, we'll see if that comes out in the light of day. Conversely to what I asked there about your favourite case or the most compelling, is there an element of the UFO topic, this phenomenon, that you study but you just can't quite get into it? Is there something you think, even for you, it's part of UFO lore, part of UFO myth, but it's just too far?
Well, I mean, certainly I think that, you know, the contactees is a little ridiculous. We talked about that.
what element of it, though, for you, what is it about contactees that you think
is too much?
Is it an element? Is it the whole thing? Is it a part of the story?
Oh, I think just the idea that they flew into spaceships and they met with the Venusians who looked just like us. To me, that's a little much. But I think I kind of struggle a little bit with some of the time travel theories.
Okay,
I find that interesting. That certainly that, like, could it be us? Is a really fascinating topic. Somehow, it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that time travel could be possible to make that an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes up a little bit in the Rendlesham Forest story, in kind of a wacky way. So that was one I thought was maybe a bit of a reach, but I think for me at least, it's easier for my head to wrap my head around the idea that an intelligent civilization could exist on one of these exoplanets. It's in the Goldilocks zone where it could thrive like we did. It has the conditions to thrive into intelligent creatures that can think and they can see the universe around it and then, you know, figure out how to transport itself from one end of it to another. It's easier for me to accept that than, like, we can travel through time. That's just, I guess, maybe a personal thing, but it's harder for me to see how that could work.
I get that. I've just had Michael Masters on a couple of times on the podcast, and his theory is the prevailing future human theory, that it's not time travel in the sense of Back to the Future, which he hates because he doesn't like the way Back to the Future portrays time travel. He thinks it's ruined it a bit, but he explains it far more scientifically. But do you think that's one of the reasons the general public at large struggle with that sort of idea, that maybe it's not as simple as something comes from a different planet to here? That's a very simple way to understand it. Something's got a better technology than us. It can travel here from really far away. And for them, it's maybe not that far. But the idea that it's something coming from a future, an alternative timeline, a different dimension, is that not only harder to understand, but pretty scary and daunting?
maybe both of those, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little hard to understand. I mean, there is the idea of another dimension is interesting, and I like where Jacques Vallée has gone with that topic in the past. Mm. I touched on it a little bit in the book.
Yeah.
The idea of all these sort of odd experiences with other creatures, whether it's aliens or ghosts, whatever, might be another dimension. And who's to say? I mean, that does seem possible. I mean, there's so much I feel like we still don't know about our own planet, that maybe there are answers that are still local to this world as opposed to another. And so, you know, I spoke with Lou Elizondo, and he kind of talked about that a little bit. He talked about, like, how the role of, like, you know, fungi was like a whole world that was unknown mm-hmm. for a while, you know, and there's like a whole thing of, like, microorganisms, you know, there's like a yep. whole world that's right under our noses that we didn't know about for so long. But there it is. So could there be something else like that we just haven't discovered yet that exists within our own world? And you know, that's quite possible. It's one of those things, like, this kind of goes along with the idea of distance as well with, you know, other worlds within this galaxy, or other galaxies. But we can't be so arrogant to think that we know everything there is to know right now. There's so much more we can learn. And that I always wonder, like, what people thought, you know, 100 years ago. They probably thought, wow, we know a lot, you know.
Yeah.
Never imagined that we'd be doing what you and I are doing right now.
Sure.
So how much more of that is there still to uncover and learn about ourselves and maybe even within our own minds, projecting things or experiencing things. I don't know. But part of what's fun about this whole subject is that mystery is still out there. And we just hope to get closer and closer to some answers.
Well, I had a few more questions, but I've got listener questions to go over, and some of those touch on what I would have asked you anyway. So I'll get to the listener questions, Mark, to finish off, if that's good with you. First up from Smartian, he asks, he'd be interested to know your general hypothesis for the UFO phenomenon, or if you're not sure on one, what you think this might be, some different speculations you might have.
Oh, man. That's a good question. I don't know that I have one thought that I think explains it. I mean, I guess I would say two things. One is, like, there's something else here that we haven't learned about, like we just kind of talked about. And maybe that's just within the role of physics itself. Mm-hmm. I talked about briefly, like, in the book, there's something, and actually NASA just talked about this at their briefing last month, I believe it was early September, where there's things like sprites and elves, which is lightning that kind of shoots up from clouds. And we didn't know about that for a long time. And pilots would report seeing things above the clouds. We learned what that was, that there was this other weather phenomenon that was just unknown to us until we had satellites like that could look down and see that. Mm-hmm. And so we learned something new when those reports come to an end. So is there something else like that in our universe that we just haven't learned about yet that might be some kind of explanation? That's interesting to me. I am intrigued by the idea that something else could be out there on one of these exoplanets that has managed to survive, a civilization that's gone beyond ours and began earlier. So it's evolved, you know, way past where we are now. And maybe they did find a way to make it here. When you start to go down that line of thinking, it's easy to say that we haven't found evidence of them because if they're that good to get, you know, that intelligent to get here, they're intelligent enough to stay hidden if they want to. So that's an intriguing thought. I'd kind of like to think that, you know, if they did get here, they would make it known so everyone could know. But I'm also kind of relieved that we are. If that's the case, the fact that we're here still is a good sign that whatever their intent is, it seems to be a good one. Because otherwise, we would certainly be gone by now. So, I don't know. I hope that kind of answers the question. It's a good question. It's hard to kind of nail one down, I think.
It does. And I've said, Mark, my opinion's quite fluid on it. And I think that's a good way to be in this topic and not nail your colours too much to the mast. Yeah. I like the idea that maybe it's something a bit closer to home. And if people haven't seen the movie The Abyss from James Cameron, I don't think that's a million miles from maybe something that might be going on. Something's here, we just can't see it. The ocean's a very big place and almost a whole other planet that we've not explored at the minute. So fascinating to discuss as well. Michael Ashworth asks, let's see what hypotheses are, because the real big questions are, who are they, what's their agenda? But also he asks, and you've covered those within the previous question, do you think there's any chance that this non-human intelligence could be a very advanced AI?
Ooh. Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly you got to think that if something's coming, it could just be controlled by AI, right? I mean, that's basically what we're doing with the rovers on Mars, right? We're controlling them from here. And there's AI integrated into those. So that certainly would make sense to some degree that if they're intelligent enough to send something here, they could have AI to kind of run it and control it. What I would like to think is that there's something on the other side of AI as well, and it's not just purely AI. That's a little scary and disturbing because it feels a little close to home where we might be finding ourselves too soon if things get out of control. That's an interesting thought. Could be some degree of that, at least.
A question from Hamish. He asks, do you think that there is anything to various different neurodivergent conditions such as autism that could have anything to do with people's experiences? And that's not that they're making them up, but just that people's brainwave or brain functions being different could be what could attract some sort of other experience.
I do, actually. I find autism to be really quite fascinating. because it shows that the brain can do things that we typically can't conceive that it could do. You see that with like the guys who do like huge math equations, right? Like multiply eight-digit numbers like that faster than you can type it into a calculator. And I can't process how that's possible. Like, I just can't. I don't know how that works. I actually just, I'm sorry if I'm going off topic for a second, but I actually just, in my day job's in advertising, and we just did some videos for a client where we used a guy who has autism. His name is Max Park. He's the world's fastest Rubik's Cube solver.
I was just about to mention that to you, that I saw a video of a kid, actually, it was juggling Rubik's Cubes, and he was solving them as he juggled them. And I just thought, like you say,
I've seen that too.
There's one, having a skill, but being able to compute what must be going through your head as you do that is just otherworldly. I get you. Sorry to interrupt.
No, this guy, Max, did it in 3.3 seconds. When we filmed him for this ad, he did four of them within 30 seconds. Picking them up, that includes time to pick it up, look at it, and then done.
Yeah.
And again, my brain can't process how that's possible. So I guess what I'm getting at here in a very long-winded way is, one, maybe there's something like the listener asked that is being picked up by another intelligence that is able to communicate. Or does it come back to what we were talking about before of it being something more to this world that is just unknown within the brain itself? Are there different ways the brain might work that might project these kinds of images? That said, I can see how that could explain certain cases, but not all. Like, that to me doesn't answer the Phoenix Lights at all. But there's another interesting thing around this topic. I wrote about this in Chasing Ghost. There was an experiment done by a professor in Canada. His name is Michael Persinger, who was looking at electromagnetic waves and how that can affect the brain. And he had a thing called the God helmet, put this helmet on people, and would kind of dial up and down the amount of electromagnetic waves that were going into the temporal lobes of the brain and have complete sensory deprivation while this was happening. I'm just doing this as a quick nutshell. But people were seeing all kinds of things. They were experiencing ghosts, which is why I was in that book, God, which is why it's called the God helmet, and UFOs and aliens. So are there certain things that might be hitting our brains that are causing people to have certain experiences? I don't know, but I find that a fascinating possibility that might explain some things, but again, not all.
And the idea of ghosts.
Keeps the mystery alive.
Yeah. And ghosts, gods, angels, demons, aliens, UFOs. Is it just different labels for the same thing? And that's just a phenomenon. That's how it's understood. Yeah. So,
You know, and touching on that really quick, we talked briefly about the fact I had an ancient section, the Bible stuff. I always find it interesting when people will be religious and believe in God and angels and the existence of that, but not the possibility of UFOs or aliens. Like, to me, it's like, isn't it just vernacular, like terminology? I mean, how can one exist, but the other couldn't possibly exist? Like, to me, that doesn't make sense at all. So again, to me, if you accept this, you got to accept this too, that the possibility of it.
Yeah. Why not? It's just terminology, like alien spacecraft and whatnot, for words we didn't have back 2000 years ago, and they used angels, demons, fiery chariots in the sky, you know, all those types of things. How the was it Roman burning shields in the sky, because there was no flying saucer, there was no spacecraft, there was nothing interdimensional being, wasn't in the vernacular.
You use the words that you've got, you know.
There was no word for blue once to describe the sea. It was described as silver, I believe. So that's just the time and what you go with. So, but listen, Mark, we're running out of time with yourself. And just before we finish off, how can people get in touch with you and also find your work as well?
The book should be available wherever you buy books. Go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org. Hopefully your local bookstore should have it. And you can find me. I have a site, markhartsmanbooks.com. It's Mark with a C. And you can find me on Instagram at Mark Hartsman, just all together, on Twitter also at Mark Hartsman. And I post quite a bit, mostly on Instagram, actually.
Awesome. I've tagged you on a tweet to say I was recording, so I managed to find you on Twitter as well, or X, as the cool kids call it.
Yeah, I'm not used to saying that yet.
No, it's so hard to say. And listen, the book, to give it its full title, we've got We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears, and Fantasies. Mark, I genuinely enjoyed it. It's one of the best looking books I've seen, and I 100% am ordering the hardcover, and I love a hardcover copy of a book. There's not enough of them about these days either. So thank you very much your time, Mark, and it was lovely speaking with you.
Thanks so much, Andy. Really appreciate it. Good talking with you.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass.